Coming up on this week's book show, Brendan Slocum's debut thriller, The Violin Conspiracy, is a page-turner about a black classical musician's desperate quest to recover his lost family heirloom violin on the eve of the most prestigious musical competition in the world. Brendan Slocum on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Brendan Slocum's debut thriller, The Violin Conspiracy, is a page-turner about a black classical musician's desperate quest to recover his lost family heirloom violin on the eve of the most prestigious musical competition in the world. Ray McMillan has a gift and a dream. He is determined to become a world-class professional violinist, and nothing will stand in his way. Not his mother, who wants him to stop making such a racket. Not the fact that he can't afford a violin suitable to his talents. And not even the racism inherent in the world of classical music. When he discovers that his great-great-grandfather's beat-up old fiddle is actually a priceless Stradivarius, all his dreams suddenly seem within reach. And then the violin is stolen. Brendan Slocum holds a degree in music education from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. For more than 20 years, he has been a public and private school music educator. He has performed with orchestras throughout the nation. The new novel is The Violin Conspiracy, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Brendan Slocum to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. It is my pleasure to be here.
What was it that brought you to say, okay, I want to address many of these things within the confines of a good old-fashioned thriller?
I actually was carrying around these stories and a lot of stories like them for years and years and years, and 2020 happened, and that gave me an opportunity not only to write, but I feel like the world was in a much better place to receive stories like this, with the events of, in particular, George Floyd. You know, there was just no escaping anyone seeing what was happening and people's perceptions of what actually does happen to people of color. I think it was very enlightening for a lot of people, so I felt the timing was good.
One of the things that goes on, and I don't want to put the cart before the horse here, but there are many stories, as you say, that you tell, and you disclose this in the author's note at the end of the novel, of just horrible things that happened to you as a young musician and racist things that happened to you. I'm interested in how then what happened in 2020 started to ignite to say, okay, these stories are important to tell. And oh, by the way, I know a lot of other people who have a lot of other stories that are just like this.
In my opinion, it's a lot about people's perceptions of what happens. Like, I would go, you know, like my string quartet. I couldn't be the person a lot of times to meet the potential clients because, you know, they would think differently if a black person was coming up to them with a violin saying, yeah, I'm going to come and play at your wedding. And the perception would be a lot different than, say, the white cellist in my group would, you know, go and say, yes, we're here to play for your wedding. Just the reaction is a lot different. As I talk to people, you know, I talk to my friends and I would share stories, and I often would get, yeah, you're exaggerating. Nah, it's really not as bad as you think. You're just being paranoid. It's not quite like that. But, you know, deep down, not even really deep down, but I knew that's exactly how it was. And these things actually do happen. It's I'm very sad to say that, but things like this really do happen. And in talking to people, I've gotten a lot of comments from people saying, yeah, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. I can totally relate to Ray's story in the book because similar situations have happened to me, and they happen quite often.
One of the things that happens to Ray is that he doesn't even get the support of his mother. The violin is just a noisemaker, and you can go out and get a job at Popeyes. You don't need to be a classical violinist. The problem with this character is that he has great talent. How did you overcome that?
Wow. Just through sheer perseverance and having very supportive people around me. I want to just go on record as saying my mom was not nearly as bad as Ray's mom in the book. So if there is anyone wondering, wow, Brendan, your mom was really like that? No, she was as supportive as she could be, not really getting it. You know, I was a black guy playing violin, and no one had seen that around where I was. No one had seen that. No one in my family had experienced anything like that. So it was something brand new. And it was, okay, what can I do? I don't really get it, but if you like it, okay, that's great for you. I think the support of people, there's always a mentor who is going to encourage you the right way and always be honest in critiques of you and in everything that you do. I had some tremendous mentors who just helped me. I would not be where I am today were it not for their help. My college violin teacher, Rochelle Vetter Huang, you know, she not only taught me how to play the violin, she taught me how to teach. She instilled in me confidence that I didn't know that existed. You know, without her help, I probably would be working at Popeyes, or I would be in jail, or I would be probably dead.
I mean, you make that point that as a young black man, the chances of you living past 25 aren't great.
Yeah, and that's not hyperbole. It was rough growing up. You know, the opportunities weren't there. The socioeconomic opportunities, the anything. It was everything always seemed out of reach. And then to add on to that, well, you're going to play a classical instrument. You're going to play it, and you're going to make something of yourself by doing it. That seemed like an impossible task. You know, it was enough to, you know, get out of the situation that you were in one piece, let alone go to college, let alone make a career. So when I say that I was almost an endangered species, I didn't want to be a statistic. That's not hyperbole. It's really true.
We talked about the difference between the mom in the book and the mom in real life. The grandmother, however, Nora, is very much real.
Yes, she is. She is my actual grandmother. She was before she passed on. The sweetest woman you've ever met in your life. Like 5 feet tall, pink and green rollers in her hair, which clashed with the blue stuff that, I don't know if old ladies do this anymore, but you know, like they would put blue stuff in their hair. And yeah. Grandma, why is your hair blue? I don't get it, but it's really cool. You know, it's blue. And she was the sweetest, most supportive lady you've ever met, ever. Just the nicest woman. She always supported everything, not only her kids, but what her grandchildren did as well.
In the novel, Nora is one that encourages Ray to play the violin, wants to hear him play while other family members do not. And not only that, but tells Ray about this violin that is probably in the attic. He goes on a scavenger hunt, finds it, and this fiddle, as it is referred to, turns out to be a $10+ million Stradivarius.
Yes, absolutely. Grandma Nora was pretty slick. I like to think that she knew she was setting Ray up for success. Not the fact that she knew that it was, you know, an extremely valuable instrument, but she knew that he was worth giving it to. It meant so much to her and so much to her family. You know, her grandfather played it to keep him and his family alive. So it had very special meaning. So she knew that by giving it to Ray, that it would have special meaning to him as well, and he would be worthy of it and would take care of it.
It comes to her husband because the slave owner who dies then gives the violin. The great-great-grandfather is playing the violin for the slave owner. And, I mean, that is a very powerful story, which also sets up, okay, so who eventually steals the instrument? Is it Ray's own family members who want the violin sold and the money distributed? Or is it the family of this slave owner who also want the money?
Yeah, it could go either way. There are several directions that it could have gone. And when I was writing that, I was like, wow, this is a really interesting angle. Who could it have been? And with the whole family angle, it makes sense. You know, it's like, well, it's a $10 million instrument. Why would you not sell it? You could buy something, you know, maybe not quite as good, but it would be pretty good. You know, $10 million. Right. What could we do with that? Why are you being so selfish? You know, split some of that with your family. And as far as the Marx family, who are the descendants of the slave owners, you know, well, this is ours. He stole it. You know, there's no way that my great-great-grandfather would have given a slave this instrument. He had to have taken it. You know, it's about perception.
Brendan Slocum is our guest. The name of the book is The Violin Conspiracy, a novel, and it is out from Anchor Books. What kind of research did you do into art theft, of what happens when things like this are indeed stolen? I mean, it's not like you just put them up on eBay.
I actually did a lot of extensive research. I called some insurance companies that insure valuable art and valuable instruments. I called private detectives. I called FBI agents. When I say it was extensive. And I heard stories about, well, I found this instrument once, and this is where it was, and this is what people were doing. And it was really, it was quite fascinating to me to learn that when people have these high value pieces of art, instruments included, they normally just kind of sit. They don't get played. They don't get sold. You can't like sell it on the street. You really can't put it on eBay. And if you're not a player, it literally just sits there for a couple of years until they get tired of it. And then they just kind of sell it on the black market. It's really a shame.
One of the things that you alluded to, of course, was these mentors that you had. And you write about Ray's mentor, Dr. Janice Stevens, who guides him through his path from this teenager to a world-class concert violinist. And Janice is also the one who says, okay, so yeah, make this your story about this is the instrument, and make it about you and make it about the instrument. Mm-hmm. And then the instrument, of course, gets stolen. But the idea that so much of the story is the instrument is fascinating as well, isn't it?
I think so. Just, you know, the violin itself, it holds so much history. Not only because of, you know, its provenance, but also because it belongs to Ray now and what he could potentially do with it, let alone that it's just a $10 million violin. This violin is actually a part of Ray. He considers it a part of himself. And, you know, as a violinist, you know, when you have your instrument and it's an extension of you, and right. If someone takes your instrument, that's a part of you that is gone. And it's until you get it back, you feel like you are truly missing something.
He holds it when he's playing it on stage at the end. He holds it out, mm-hmm. as if sharing the applause with the instrument itself.
Right. That was like a tribute to basically everyone that came before him. You know, he would not have been able to be in the position that he was in performing for these people, you know, who are paying exorbitant amounts of money to come and hear him play, had it not been for the people that came before him. You know, had his pop not suffered through everything that he went through as a child growing up, you know, to make it to where he was, to be able to hand the instrument down. So it really is a tribute to the people that came before him. And that was a lot of fun to do. I was like, this will be a nice way to pay tribute. And it really says something about Ray's character in the story.
It also brings us to where Ray is headed, and one of the places where Ray is headed is the worldwide Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow. This is a competition that happens every 4 years, right? I think.
Yes.
Every 4 years.
And I like to call it the Olympics of classical music.
That's right. And not often won by an American. And I think, has there been ever a violinist, an American violinist, who has won?
Never been an American violinist who's won first place.
And I believe the first to come in second was Eugene Fodor, but that goes back to the 70s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It is fascinating because that is also, in and of itself, a stuffy world where not only do you have racism, which you're writing about, but you also have this very anti-American sentiment that is present within that competition, all the while poor Ray is trying to find the violin that was stolen and is playing a replacement instrument.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like when it rains, it pours, and then it pours some more, and then it rains some more, and then it just keeps pouring. It's just like Ray can't win. He's already at a cutthroat competition that he's worked really hard for. And then he has to go and compete against all of these world-class people that have every advantage over him. And then the fact that he's an American, they look at him like, yeah, you shouldn't be here anyway. And then you're a black American. What is going on? Why are you even here? So there's just a ton that he's got to overcome. And then on top of that, his instrument that he loves so much and that's a part of him has been stolen. And he feels like, you know, if he does compete, it's going to be on an inferior instrument. So every single thing you can imagine has been stacked against him.
You write beautifully about performing, about playing. For the concerto's final movement, he started uncharacteristically slow, a warning shot, daring them, and then winding up the tension, driving forward into a speed that made it seem as if his bow hand were not even part of his body, a flickering mosquito or a hummingbird barely visible. The melody vibrated off him, clear, uncolored, rich itself. The final note hung in the air like a cloud. Not only is that beautiful writing, but it seems to me that could only be written by someone who has had that power to create that music to come from an instrument.
As I was writing a lot of the musical descriptions, I really had to go and talk to people and let them read it, people that were not musicians. Being able to talk shop with someone, we could just use all kinds of technical terms that you and I would understand, but the average person who's not a musician, they wouldn't get it. So I really had to kind of hone in, and I would let people read certain passages. Like, does this make sense to you? No, not at all. Brendan, this may as well be a foreign language. All right, let me go back. I described Ray starting the final movement of the Tchaikovsky concerto. Bum, ba-da-dum, bum, bum. You know, I've heard people play it. I've had colleagues play it. And I just love a dramatic warm-up. I was like, you know what? Ray is here. He is going to do this. And he is just going to milk every second of it. So yeah, he's going to wind just from the very start. And I just wanted everyone to experience what it was that he was doing and what he was feeling. And you don't need to know anything about music, but you could feel what was going on and what he was giving to the audience at that moment.
All of this is happening while there's so much tension. As you said, when it rains, it pours. And there's so much rain coming down as the story is unfolding. Did you always know who ultimately was going to be? I mean, you set up the series of suspects of the theft, but did you always know who was going to be the person who took it?
I actually made the decision for the thief. I made that decision about halfway through writing it. There could have been, like you mentioned, several suspects. And I was like, okay, I think this will be good. This will be satisfying. And it's funny, one of my former students was reading the book last night, and he was halfway through, and he said, I'm not going to read another word until you tell me who it was. This is my list of suspects. And he named people in the book that I hadn't even thought of. I was like, oh, wow, that is a really good, that's an interesting theory. I should have explored that a bit more. But it didn't come to me until about halfway through. And in retrospect, I'm glad I did it that way because it also kept me guessing. It kept me wanting to keep things fresh and moving along and just wanting to keep people, well, I wonder who it could have been. No, they wouldn't. Would they? Yeah, well, maybe. Well, I don't know. Just the options. I wanted the options to be as plentiful as possible.
Brendan Slocum is the author of The Violin Conspiracy. The book is published by Anchor. At any time through this research, did you get to play a Stradivarius?
Not yet, but until I do play a Stradivarius, my work is not done. I am working on it, any and everything that I can do. The closest I've come is seeing Istok Perlman in concert a couple of times. And, you know, I got close, but I didn't get to touch it. I didn't get to play it, but I still think there's time.
Yeah, I would think so, especially given the fact that this is now work that you have done. The screen rights have been sold. So who knows, right? What could happen?
There's always hope. And I'm going to be waiting by the phone if anyone would like to offer me the opportunity to play a Strad. Hey, I am totally willing. I'm totally capable. I've practiced. I'm ready for it. I'm totally right. I know exactly what I'm going to play.
What does it say about, you know, they don't make them like they used to? I mean, what is it that is still, and I don't think will ever be replaced as the gold standard?
You know, that's a really, really interesting question, and one that has been asked often and never quite answered fully. The research that I've done, and from what I know, just off the top of my head, is that the only way to truly, truly find out what makes a Stradivarius instrument so, you know, the top of the line gold standard, let's say platinum standard, because it's just, I mean,
right,
there's nothing else like it.
Right.
The only way that you can really find out would be to destroy one and reconstruct it from the outside in. And no one is willing to do that.
You wrote much of the book during COVID. I mean, this was you do a lot of teaching. The teaching sort of is difficult because of COVID. So this came really in the nick of time.
Absolutely. You know, COVID just kind of did a number on everyone. And I'm sitting at home. I was supposed to go and play some weddings and play some receptions and play dinners and with my string quartet. And all of that just kind of dried up. And then the lessons that I teach just stopped as well. And you can only do so much over Zoom. So I had a lot of time to sit. And I did a lot of sitting during the summer of 2020 with COVID. And I was eating constantly and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I decided this is not going to work because I can't go and buy any more clothes and, you know, it's not working. So I turned to writing. And when I sent off my manuscript to an agent, was very honest and said, yeah, this is terrible, but your voice is really good. So you should try writing something that, you know, I submitted a science fiction thing that I'm going to redo one of these days. Now that I'm much, much better writer, I can go back to the science fiction aspect. But I submitted and he said, you know, you've got a good voice, so you should try writing what you know. And in 2.5 months, I had the Violin Conspiracy written.
So now you let me ask you about future work, which you just brought up in science fiction. So you're not always going to be, quote unquote, married to the idea of staying in a classic musical milieu.
I will say with all honesty, I mean, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I, as a musician, everything that I write is probably going to have a musical tint to it, which is totally fine. And I think I'm good to the point where I can incorporate everyday average people who are not musicians, where they would be able to appreciate and understand it. The things that I write are not so, you know, involved with music that it's all music all the time. It won't be anything like that. But my second book, I'm actually in the middle of doing revisions right now. It is a musical themed book, but it also deals with issues of people living with autism, which I'm really excited to share with people. Musicians. If I can get, just give the premise really quick.
Sure.
It's about a composer, the preeminent composer of the United States. He is bigger than Beethoven, bigger than Mozart, bigger than Brahms. And it's his 150th anniversary. The world will be celebrating this man's 150th birthday. And a musicologist has been hired to do some research on him to present at his 150th anniversary celebration. The musicologist discovers that he may have appropriated most of his music from a black woman that we would consider living with autism today. And the foundation that supports him, which is made up of the descendants of the composer, will stop at nothing to keep that information from getting out.
So the ancestry is something that you are fascinated with.
I really am. It's not something that a lot of people spend a lot of time focusing on. And to me, that aspect is really, really interesting. And you can learn a lot of things. Sometimes it gets a little uncomfortable, but I think those are the best things that we can do, is to, you know, experience those uncomfortable situations, read those uncomfortable passages, do that uncomfortable research. The only way that we are going to get past it is we've got to revisit it. And with the ancestry angle, I think this is a good way with the writing. It's a good way to introduce people to, once again, different perspectives that they would not normally have had, you know, information that they were completely unaware of.
There are many uncomfortable passages that you read in this novel about what Ray goes through, as I alluded to earlier in our conversation, and even more so when we realize at the end of the book, as you say, that these things actually happened to you. Is it possible, or is it even worth extricating racism versus racism within the arts and the world of classical music?
I think there's no distinction. I don't think there is a distinction. But what I do think that there is, you can make a distinction on the rationale as to why it happens. In the arts, in my opinion, and I'm not speaking for, you know, an entire race of people, in my opinion, it's just a matter of ignorance. Yeah. It's like, well, a lot of people think because I'm a black man, I am not capable of playing classical music. Well, why do you think that? Well, I've never seen it. And, you know, when I see people like you, people who look like you, I get an impression of something, and it's not of playing classical music. Well, why is that? Well, I don't know. Well, let's look into that. Let's look a little bit deeper. If you think about it, I am a normal everyday guy. I, you know, get up in the morning, I put my pants on one leg at a time. I do the same things that everyone else does. I just happen to be black as I'm playing a violin. And a lot of times people's perceptions are that, well, you don't like this kind of music, or you're not going to be good at this type of music. So we're going to try to steer you towards something else that you can be successful at. I can be successful, and people that look like me can be successful, just as successful at any and everything anyone else can. We just need the opportunity.
And without stereotyping, it does seem that often within the arts, the benefactors are people who probably consider themselves, well, not only they are wealthy, they are giving money to the arts, probably consider themselves to be very liberal and quite woke.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's a big part of the problem, too. It's you know, you someone told you that, and this is what it's going to take. And that's it. Oh, I did it. So I check all the boxes. I meet the criteria. There's so much more to it than, you know, giving a couple of bucks or saying that you attended something. You know, it's all about opportunity. If you are a patron and you are contributing, let's say, to the Chicago Symphony, contribute money so that the Chicago Symphony can go to an inner school more than one time. Contribute money so that an inner city kid can listen to classical music, can touch a violin, can hold an oboe and make a sound, give them a reed. You know, let's pump music through the classrooms. Let's put sound systems into where one day we get to hear rock and roll. The other day we get to hear classical music. The next day we get to hear hip hop. The day after that we get to hear bluegrass. It's all about exposure. And if you have the means to make changes where people can be exposed to these things, to me, that is being more woke in a proper way. That's the way to do it.
Brendan Slocum's new novel is The Violin Conspiracy. It is published by Anchor Books. Brendan, what a delight to speak to you, and thank you so much for such a terrific read. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much, Joe. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.